Today, we are pushing ahead with a series of interviews with the Labour leadership candidates. We spoke to Rebecca Long-Bailey before the coronavirus crisis reached this intensity.
Are you enjoying it?
The campaign? Enjoy's not the word I'd use to describe it. It's been interesting.
Are you going to stand for leadership of the Labour Party?
Well, the honest answer is that I'm seriously thinking about it. We've just had the most shattering defeat where you really felt in towns like mine that the earth was quaking, and we've watched the entire Labour base just crumble beneath our feet.
We cannot fight the Tories if we're fighting each other. Factionalism has to go.
And I will fight for modern democratic public ownership. I will fight for all of these things. And that is why I am standing to become the leader of the Labour Party.
Despite coronavirus, the Labour leadership election will go ahead. So our series of interviews with the candidates continues. Whoever wins will be the one to hold Boris Johnson to account in this crisis. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Rebecca Long-Bailey's pitch for the leadership. Can you remember the first day you arrived in Parliament? What was it like?
I remember getting a bag, and I've still got it now, that said, "Welcome to Parliament 2015. And wandering around and not knowing where I was going at all. And I remember Angela Rayner being very excited. And we've got a photo of the two of us without lines under our eyes when we didn't know what was about to happen to our lives, smiling because we were excited that we'd got to Parliament.
Rebecca Long-Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Deputy Speaker, for giving me the opportunity to make my maiden speech during this debate. I am a proud socialist, and if any city personifies the struggles of the working class and the labour movement, it is Salford.
And when you arrived in Parliament in 2015, one of the first things you must have done was nominate Jeremy Corbyn for the leadership. We were just looking back at the odds. He was 500-1 at the start of the campaign. So from the outside, that looks like a bold decision to get on board with such an outsider as soon as you walk through the door. Why did you back him?
Well, when I went into Parliament, I honestly thought that I'd be a bit more like Dennis Skinner.
Offering him best wishes for his birthday on Sunday, I call Mr. Dennis Skinner.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know about that.
Dennis Skinner is an absolute legend, the beast of Bolsover.
I don't think you should celebrate age. Anyway, there are another group of people that need help. And they're the people that work in the National Health Service.
Yes.
Doesn't hold back in saying what he thinks. He's a socialist legend. He quite often was there shouting at Theresa May from the front benches on the opposition side.
Long-term stability under this government. Coming and going. It's high time this government did the same as we did between 97 and 2010. Get weaving.
And yes. And happy birthday, Dennis.
So you wanted to be on the back benches shouting from the left?
That's right, that's what I thought was going to happen. And my job would be to shape the policies of the party and push it into the direction that I thought it needed to go in. And I honestly thought that that was maybe a 15, 20 year project because I didn't think it would happen as quickly as I wanted it to. And then in the first few weeks of Parliament, obviously I'd made friends with a number of the MPs on the Socialist Campaign Group. And we were meeting to discuss who was going to be the Socialist Campaign Group's candidate. Everyone said, "Jeremy, it's your turn. You need to do this now." And he was like, "Oh, okay, if everybody thinks I should, then I will." And I thought long and hard because I thought to myself at the time, I thought, how can I influence policy in the best way? Is it by backing Jeremy or is it by trying to influence one of the other candidates? And I searched my soul and I realised the reason that I'm in Parliament is because of what I believe in. And I'll never forgive myself if I don't pick the candidate that best represents my beliefs.
Hi, everybody.
everybody. My name's Rebecca Long Bailey, and I'm the new Labour MP for Salford and Eccles. I'm voting for Jeremy because consensus is not an option anymore. We can either accept that life is as best as it can get, or we can be the masters of our own destiny, where anything is possible, and those who dare to dream make those dreams a reality. Now, Jeremy is the man to do this. Thank you.
I never thought in a million years he was going to win.
Jeremy Corbyn, 251,417 votes, which represents 59.5%. I am therefore delighted to declare Jeremy Corbyn elected as leader of the Labour Party.
It was the start of a new chapter for the Labour Party, and you were there from the start. How did it feel?
It was like a dream come true at the time, and obviously what happened afterwards wasn't a dream because it was a very difficult time for everybody. But I'd felt, and this is one of the reasons why I hadn't become directly involved in politics until I was nearly in my 30s, really. And it's because I'd felt that the party had become an austerity-like party and it didn't represent the values that I thought the Labour Party should represent. And when Jeremy won, I could see us moving back towards those values and I thought, this is it now, this is our chance.
In these interviews, we want to focus on a specific story that helps understand you better as a politician and potential leader of the Labour Party. And if I look at your Westminster CV after that moment in 2015, what really stands out, which we'd like to look at, is an incredibly rapid rise. Mm-hmm. 2 years from a brand new MP to a shadow business secretary who was already being talked about as a potential leader. That rise began straight away. You got a job in Corbyn's first shadow front bench. What was that like? Did you feel ready for it?
Well, I was shadow exchequer secretary, which is one of the most exciting jobs in shadow cabinet. It was like a baptism of fire, I suppose. And it was like that for many of the shadow cabinet at the time. You had to learn very quickly and also develop policies very, very quickly.
So within a year, the party was in the midst of the EU referendum campaign, arguing for Remain. Some on the left, some in that socialist grouping that you were part of had long been Eurosceptic, including Corbyn.
On a scale of 1 to 10, where one is couldn't really care less about the EU and 10 is I'm jumping on the couch like Tom Cruise on Oprah, how passionate are you about staying in the EU?
Oh, I'd put myself in the upper half of the 5 to 10, so we're looking at 7, 7.5.
Ooh, not quite.
Maybe 7.
After the result, a lot of senior figures in Labour who, let's be honest, had been unsure about the leadership from the start, decided to resign en masse.
Your name and title, please, Lucy.
Yeah, Lucy Powell, a Labour MP for Manchester Central, no longer in the shadow cabinet.
It was a very strange few days as one shadow minister after another announced they were leaving.
I felt the only decent and honourable thing to do was to resign.
I said personally, directly to Jeremy, look, you can try and hold on for grim death if you want, but it will be the death of the Labour Party.
I just don't think that he can communicate or lead the party in these tumultuous times. I think he must be feeling wretched. I think a lot of us are feeling wretched. I'm certainly feeling wretched.
You decided to stay put. How hard was that period?
It was horrible, if I'm honest. It was horrible for everyone that was involved. I heard, you know, stories of many members of the PLP in tears because they were being put under so much pressure by other colleagues to resign. We had stories of people wandering down corridors and being told they were a disgrace because they hadn't resigned. So it was quite a fractious and tumultuous time. And at the time for the people who were left, it was very, very difficult. Some people ended up doing a few different portfolios to try and keep things together. I remember running backwards and forwards down the corridors to make sure that we had the front bench covered at all times, because at any point there wasn't somebody sat there when there was a debate in Parliament from the front bench. That gave ammunition to those who wanted to get rid of Jeremy, that they could state that we weren't an effective opposition. So it was incredibly difficult.
How damaging was that for the party?
It was very damaging because nobody's going to vote for a party that's that divided. And unfortunately, these spats were played out in full public view. We had various people going on to the media, and this continued after the so-called coup as well. And
so-called chicken coup.
A so-called chicken coup, that's right. And you know, we should have been unifying as a party.
And of course, the other two candidates in this race, Keir Starmer resigned, Lisa Nandy resigned, and then co-chaired Owen Smith's leadership challenge. Do you think that tells us anything about you and the other candidates?
Well, I mean, I mean, I don't want to say anything negative about the other candidates because we all get on very well. And I think now is the time not to regurgitate the wars of the past, but to look to the future now and unify, because we'll only win a general election as a unified party. But I think, it, you know, you can read into that. There was, you know, I decided to stay and support Jeremy. And it was because I believed in the things that he believed in. But it was also because I thought that it was right to support the elected leader of the party. And that's what I'll do after this leadership election. If I don't win, even if I don't agree with the leader all of the time, I'll support them and I'll discuss with them my concerns behind closed doors, because that's what you do.
And after that, after all those resignations, you were actually promoted into the shadow cabinet. You got the role of shadow chief secretary to the Treasury, essentially John McDonnell's deputy. I mean, he's talked about how impressed he was by the way you handled the coup. And it's around then that he starts talking about you as a possible future leader. I mean, you've been described many times as his protege. He's backing you for this job.
I support Becky and Richard Bergen. They're the nature of my policies. And Becky was my number two, if you remember, in the Treasury team for quite a while. She's brilliant, and I think she's that voice that we need, that northern voice, a woman's voice as well, that we need.
How much did you learn from him in that period?
Loads. I mean, John's an incredibly clever man and he's got a lot of economic experience.
And were you mates? Did you become mates?
Of course we were, yeah. No, I love John to pieces. He's a legend.
And what do you think of his leadership style?
I think it was the right type of leadership, and it certainly, it's very similar to my own, really. I think John understands that a lot of the policies that we were talking about, they're talked about as being radical, and they are compared to where we are after 10 years of austerity. But they're not actually radical when you compare them to what other countries around the world are doing. They're sensible economic policies. And to make sure that people understand that, you have to convey that message and reassure them that this makes economic common sense. And John put a lot of work into that, making sure that people understood that every single thing that the Labour Party do was fully costed. And then also developing the arguments over the long term to ensure that people understood the reasons for those policies.
OK, so you rise in the shadow cabinet again in 2017. And that was because Clive Lewis resigned over the party's Brexit policy. So by this point, even some of your fellow 2015 intake on the left of the party have started to waver in their support for Corbyn, specifically in this case over Brexit. But you've stayed put. You were selected to replace him as shadow business secretary. And not long after that, we had the 2017 election when Corbyn confounded expectations to take away Theresa May's majority.
Let's look at the changed map of the UK after another absolutely shocking election result. It's Jeremy Corbyn's 41% that is remarkable. A close second, it's thought many, many young voters pouring in to support Labour. But let's go back to the challenge facing the Conservatives. They're going to have a working arrangement with the Democratic Unionists because they're short by eight. And it's embarrassing, humiliating for the Prime Minister, Theresa May.
Did you feel vindicated? I mean, how do you look back on it?
In the 2017 general election, I was absolutely devastated, because I think if we'd been unified as a party from the time Jeremy'd become leader in 2015 up until 2017, we would have won that election. Because in the weeks prior to the manifesto being launched, all we were getting on the doorstep was who was having a row with who in the Labour Party at that particular time, because the infighting was rife. And then when the manifesto came out, we felt that there was a shift.
Tomorrow's front pages begin with a leak of Labour's manifesto. That's on the Times front page, with the paper saying the party is facing civil war. The Daily Mail's more critical. Can it be more critical than saying facing civil war? I don't know. Calling the policies Corbyn's fantasy land.
The FT looks at the same story, saying business leaders are dismayed by Labour's prioritising of state intervention over enterprise.
We still don't know who leaked it, but it was one of the biggest PR moves, I think, that ever happened within the Labour Party, because the likes of, you know, the right-wing press put on their front pages, Labour wants to renationalise water companies. And they didn't realise that most people actually think that that's a sensible idea. The same for rail and energy and investing in council housing, investing in education. These are things that people think are sensible policies to ensure that we have a prosperous economy.
So you're on record as saying it's patronising to portray you as the Corbyn continuity candidate. And let's be clear, you're not the same person. You've achieved a great deal in your career. But equally, when we look at that rise through the Labour Party, your loyalty to him is at the heart of it, or at least your loyalty to his politics. It's characterised time and again by you standing with the leadership when others resigned. So isn't it understandable that people say that?
I mean, I will never apologise for being loyal to Jeremy or the leadership of the party, because that should have been a prerequisite to anybody that was in the shadow cabinet, quite frankly, and any Labour MP, because Jeremy had been elected by our members to be the leader of the party, whether you agreed with him on everything or not. But the continuity Corbyn label, I mean, it irritates me sometimes, because there's no such thing as Corbynism, and even Jeremy has said this himself. There's socialism, and if I'm continuing socialism, then fine, I'm quite happy with that.
Okay, so how will your leadership be different?
Well, we're completely different people for a start.
In what ways?
I'm a northern woman. Jeremy's a man that lives in London who isn't the same age as me. We've got very different outlooks, although our policies and our principles are basically the same. And that's why I supported Jeremy in the first place.
Your policies are basically the same.
Well, of course they are. I mean, we believe in socialism and we believe in the principles that were set out in the manifesto. That doesn't mean to say we got everything right.
So can we just drill into that a little bit? Were there any policies in the manifesto that you thought were wrong first?
Not that they were wrong, no. There were policies that were part of a longer-term programme rather than a five-year manifesto. So I think it's important to differentiate the two. So you have your manifesto, which outlines everything that you know you'll realistically deliver within 5 years. Then you have a long-term programme, which sets out the party's longer-term aspirations. And one example I'd give is that the four-day working week, reducing working hours. That was a long-term aspiration, not a five-year project.
So it shouldn't have been in the manifesto.
So it shouldn't have been directly in the manifesto itself, because you'd only have been in a position to reduce working hours or go to a four-day working week when you'd improve productivity.
But you would be willing to make the argument for the policy?
I'd make the argument for the policy, but I think to put it as something that's deliverable within 5 years was probably the wrong move.
And what about, so you've talked about nationalisations, you've said they're really popular. The 2019 manifesto included sweeping nationalisations. Wouldn't it have been better to focus in on, for example, rail, that we know is very popular and also where the evidence is very strong, and not to have included things like broadband, which people were very sceptical about, because you lost people, they didn't trust you, and therefore they didn't focus in on the policy that could have been popular?
In terms of broadband and public ownership, we are lagging behind other industrial nations. And there's also an issue about social inclusion and people having access to the internet in a world where everything's increasingly done on the internet, all the way through from support from your local authority through to where you buy your shopping. So it was important to look at that. But what we didn't do with that policy was develop the case for publicly owned broadband. So whereas with water and energy, we'd spent 5 years explaining to people why the market was broken, why it was an economic objective to bring them into public ownership, because we needed to invest in infrastructure to create new industry and tackle climate change, for example. But with broadband, although there was a big business case for it, making sure that we improve productivity overall throughout the economy, we didn't have the time to do that. And then when we plopped it in a general election campaign, it was a shock to everyone.
And what about the critique that individually a lot of these policies are very, very popular, but not necessarily together, because people start to get overwhelmed, they don't really believe it, they see it as a shopping list, and so you lose credibility. Would your manifesto be tighter, smaller, more focused?
What you do in an election campaign, it's a sadly, you can have the greatest policies in the world, but it's all about the ground war and it's about your marketing campaign. And what you should do is pick out key policies and sell those around an overarching message. And that's what we didn't do. So we should have been talking about aspiration and the whole point of the Labour Party being there to improve the quality of people's lives, wherever you're from, whatever your income. And we had policies that demonstrated that that's what we were going to do.
Which were the key ones?
The key ones, well, a national education service, the Green Industrial Revolution.
Hard to sell, though.
It's not hard to sell. I mean, I think it was one of the policies that would have connected with every single constituency across the UK. It was about reindustrialisation, but it was also about improving people's living standards. So we were going to insulate up to 27 million homes right across the UK at no cost to the householder, because they would have seen their bills reduce as a result, and a tiny portion of the amount that they'd saved on their bills would have been used to pay off that new insulation on their homes. It would have eradicated fuel poverty as well.
So education, the environment, where else would you focus?
It's about jobs, investment and aspiration.
And in order to focus the message, you're saying that you don't want to talk so much about so many policies without the narrative, without the overarching narrative. Just before I move on, are there any that you think they would definitely go? I mean, clearly the four-day week out of the manifesto. Anything else?
No, I mean, obviously I don't want to write the 2024 manifesto here on this podcast. No, I mean, it'd take me over hours. But no, I think all of the policies that we had, I completely agree with. Now, of course, we need to build on those and they'll have to be adapted in 2024 based on where we are.
Before we move on from this, you say you're very different to Corbyn. He didn't have a great relationship with the media. How would you tackle the media? I mean, you've admitted that the media can be hostile to your politics.
We saw the character of a decent, honest, kind, principled man be chipped away day by day by certain elements of the press. And what we didn't do in the Labour Party was rebut those smears and that misinformation as quickly as we should. I think we need a rebuttal unit within the party. And that's in addition to your day-to-day press operation. We need a key team that's dedicated to rebutting smears as soon as they happen so that we can stop those lies spreading throughout the mainstream media. The second element is about being accessible to the media. Now, of course, there are elements that, you know, they'd be happy if the Labour Party never existed, if I'm honest. But most journalists want to be objective. They will hold us to account. They will scrutinise. And sometimes it will be difficult, but we need to be there, open and transparent, and have those discussions and not be frightened about it.
Stay with us. Next, I'll ask Rebecca Long-Bailey why, if all the policies were right, did Labour suffer such a massive defeat in December? It's clear to me that although you think that the policies could have been sold better, you supported the policies in 2019. And we know that you supported Corbyn. You've made that very clear. In fact, you gave him 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10?
Well, I'd give him 10 out of 10 because I respect him and I supported him all the way through.
So what was the problem? Why did you lose so badly?
Oh, there was all sorts of reasons. I mean, it was the Brexit election and I don't think we can avoid that. And certainly, I mean, I'm from a Leave constituency in Salford and I could feel the anger right the way up to the general election itself. And many people, even those who voted Remain, were angry with us because they thought that we were trying to overturn the result of the referendum. And over the last few years prior to the election, they didn't understand in many cases what we were trying to do in Parliament. They thought that we were playing parliamentary games and trying to stop Brexit from happening. And then when we went into the election with our Brexit position, we were in a very difficult place and we were trying to bring together those who wanted to leave and those who very strongly wanted to remain. But the compromise satisfied no one and it was quite difficult to convey on the doorstep and it was an absolute disaster. And that breach of trust took so many other things down with it.
Can I just focus in on Brexit? I mean, you were in an incredibly senior position. You were shadow business secretary. And this is a policy that was absolutely critical for the business community. What were you doing to try to influence the leadership or the membership to adopt a Brexit policy you thought would be more successful?
Well, remember, I was in the negotiations with the government and I worked very hard. And to be fair to my counterpart at the time, Greg Clark, we had made a lot of progress between the two of us in our individual areas. But it became very clear in those negotiations that in other areas, the government wasn't going to move position. And Theresa May at the time was losing the faith of the people around her. So even if she had agreed a compromise with us, I don't think any of her backbenchers would have supported her. So it was
really ever going to back Theresa May?
Well, honestly, in those negotiations, I'd gone in with the intention of reaching a compromise, but that wasn't possible, unfortunately.
I mean, I've suggested that when it came to Brexit policy, you had a lot of ability to influence the party. And so perhaps you take responsibility for some of the mistakes that you think were made. I mean, arguably, you could say the same about anti-Semitism. During this campaign, you've said frequently, you're going to sort this out. But how can you distance yourself from what has already happened when you were so senior?
Well, but on the Brexit point, I tried to influence as a shadow cabinet member and I warned about what would happen. And unfortunately, what I thought would happen actually did happen in the end. But that's not to say that there was an answer to this. But on the anti-Semitism issue, I don't think, and I've been quite public about this, and I was public about this when I was in the shadow cabinet, although we have taken a lot of action over the last few years, we still haven't sorted the crisis out. And the action that we have taken wasn't as robust as it needed to be. And that's why I've called for an independent process, not just for anti-Semitism complaints, but all forms of discrimination within the party, so that we can have the gold standard within political parties and people have faith in the processes that we have. I also think that we needed to have an educational programme right across our membership so that our members understood and were able to spot conspiracy theories and tropes, particularly when they were having political discussions, you know, about the situation between Israel and Palestine, so that they were reassured that they could talk about these issues. It was important for us to do that within the party, but they did so in a way that didn't veer into making anti-Semitic remarks.
But do you think it was mishandled?
Well, if it was handled properly, we would have solved the crisis. The Jewish community would be reassured, and that isn't the case. So clearly we haven't handled it in the way that we should.
It seems to me that what you're saying is if you were leader of the Labour Party, you would change the way that things were sold in the last election. Mm-hmm. You would tackle Brexit differently. But you're not afraid to say that beyond that, you'd be proud to go into the next election with largely the same offer that was taken into December 2019. Are you absolutely persuaded that that could overturn what is a massive majority for Boris Johnson?
Well, it won't be exactly the same because obviously we'll have to adapt it to meet the problems that we face in 2024. So on the industrial strategy and green industrial revolution, we'll have to have a lot more added to that policy platform if the government haven't taken the action that's required and they need to. And that's why we need to pressure them to take the action before 2024. Our job now over the next 4 years is to rebuild trust and understand that breakdown in trust happened because of Brexit and a whole range of reasons. But nobody within our communities voted to be poorer or to have a worse quality of life. They wanted improvement in their lives. They wanted change, but they didn't believe that we were the people that were going to bring that for them. And we've got to restore that trust because I know the policies that we have would have done that, but we hadn't conveyed them articulately enough and we hadn't really displayed to people what the Labour Party stood for.
Rebecca Long-Bailey, thank you very much.
Thanks.
That was Rebecca Long-Bailey speaking to me before the coronavirus epidemic took over so intensely in the UK. Since then, she, like all of us, has been focused on this crisis. The leadership race has changed dramatically. The candidates no longer have hustings. But voting continues and the winner will be announced on April the 4th. Next, we'll be talking to Keir Starmer. Before I go, I want to thank all our listeners for their continued support. We really appreciate getting feedback through reviews, so please do leave them wherever you listen to Today in Focus or tweet me at Anoushka Astana. We also now have a new way for you to get in touch with us during this period with any questions, comments and suggestions. Go to theguardian.com/COVID-19 questions, all one word. You can write to us about any of the many ways this pandemic is affecting our lives, but we'll also be asking for specific themed questions for our Friday episodes. I'll have more information on that tomorrow. If you have any specific questions about the science, then our colleagues on Science Weekly, who are also bringing you regular episodes, can be reached through that link too. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Take care and see you tomorrow.